down in town.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 423.JB3104, certificate number 32655. Erdős Bacon Sabbath.
It's the law that states that anyone in Hollywood can be linked to Kevin Bacon in six steps or less, although it turns out that so many famous actors are a mere 2 degrees of separation.
Have you ever co-authored a mathematical paper?
I have co-authored a book with another author who is a mathematician.
And
And I've never thought about this. The famous popular mathematician and science writer, Martin Gardner, who wrote the Mathematical Games column in Scientific American for many years.
Yes.
So just, you know, for generations of nerds, kind of a monthly numbers game kind of a guy, so well known in those fields. Towards the end of his life, he lived into his 90s, and towards the end of his life, he sold an idea for a book, kind of collecting a lot of his books, his writings on word games. He was also really into Lewis Carroll. If you've ever seen the annotated Alice in Wonderland that sold a bajillion copies, that was Gardner's work. He loved word games, and he sold an idea for a book collecting a lot of his word games. And then the manuscript was kind of in disarray. And then he passed away not long after that. And his publisher reached out to me and said, hey, would you like to see if there's a way to shape this stuff into a book?
His writings.
Yeah. Yeah. And I believe he was still alive when they approached me. I never got to meet him, but I was a huge fan of his work. You know, I checked out his annotated Alice from the elementary school librarian when I was a kid, and he would often have weird math facts and magic tricks and puzzles in like Scientific American and Games Magazine. And so I was like, sure, absolutely. You know, the chance to co-author something with Martin Gardner. And the manuscript was just kind of a mess because it was a bunch of his old articles. But I went through a lot of his other old writing that I could find, and I pulled out other word stuff, and I kind of tried to categorize it more like how you would build a book. And I even ended up writing a few things in what I thought were his voice, kind of expanding stuff he had written with some other ideas. And the book came out, you know, credited to Martin Gardner, I think edited by Ken Jennings. And so that was very flattering to me.
I'll say.
Even though I never got to meet the guy in his 90s, to share he was 96 when he passed. Wow. So to share a byline with him was it was very flattering. And I still display my author copies with pride. So I guess, does that count? Am I a co-author with an actual published recreational mathematician?
You are. And this is very exciting to me, and it should be very exciting to you. And I'll get to why in a moment.
Okay.
We may have to do some math on this program, or at least some calculation.
That's what you like to hear at the beginning of a podcast. You want to hear the host say, we're going to be doing some live calculation later on the air.
Well, you know, usually the inscrutable mathematics episodes of Omnibus belong to you. I don't even know if I've ever done one. And this one is not that inscrutable, but
I should hope not.
We're going to do a little calculation, and I think we're going to be very pleasantly surprised by how by the result. But I should start off by saying I think everybody is familiar in our culture now with the concept of 6 degrees of separation. It became a kind of a like a trope relating to social networks and relating to the kind of interconnectivity of the modern world. It was popularized by a Will Smith film.
Oh yeah, based on the John Guare play.
That's right.
It's about a kid who shows up and charms a wealthy Manhattan family by pretending to be Sidney Poitier's son or nephew or something, right?
Yeah, he's a scammer, and he, it's a dramatic film. And it's not strictly about the phenomenon of 6 degrees
but
of separation.
But that must come, do you know how that comes up in the...
He gives a little soliloquy at the end of the film where he kind of ruminates on, the idea. He's familiar... The character in the film is familiar with the concept of 6 degrees of separation. That's kind of how he's using our susceptibility to that idea as his scam. He's always friends of a friend,
right?
Just far enough away that you can't research it, but or can't quite figure it out. Can't figure out the connection. Rather. Can't confirm the connection, but close enough that you do feel a connection with him enough that you let him stay at your house.
I heard the trope as a kid. I think one of my parents said, well, you're only 6 degrees of separation from anyone on earth.
Right.
And I said, what does that mean? And they said, well, if you're a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, you can get to anyone, anywhere, Siberia, Mozambique, it doesn't matter where.
And it's the type of thing your parents would have said to you as a kid.
And because it was kind of a nerdy, mind-blowing thing. That, wait, that's true. If I know 100 people, and they each know 100 people, and they each know 100 people, wow, I just already got to a million
right there.
And of course, and I think even at the time I realized, wait, that's not quite true, because the people, each of those 100 people I know will be more likely to know each other than a brand new set of 100 people.
That's right.
So I don't know if anybody's ever actually done the math on how many levels it would take to get to anyone on earth.
Yeah, you don't actually have 10 trillion relatives or ancestors, because a lot of them were intermarrying so forth.
Especially my ancestors.
But the idea of that interconnectivity was a thing throughout the 20th century. Was an idea, like a cocktail party idea, that mathematicians in particular were really fascinated by, because it was a playful space that that kind of suggested all these other mathematical concepts. And especially in the mid 20th century, when mathematics and sociology and psychology and all these different kind of realms were doing quite a bit of overlapping in the august halls of MIT and Yale and Harvard. This was an idea that kind of incorporated a lot of these different other fields, where you could play with not just the math questions, but also the sociological questions.
The underlying math thing is very counterintuitive, I think, because our brains are bad at figuring out exponential growth, right?
Right.
Like, you would assume. You would naively assume, oh yeah, I know 10 people and they each know 10 people and they each know 10 people. That's probably about, 30 people? We're kind of bad at doing the, it's like the thing about the, have you heard the thing about the chessboard where the guy just requests that the king give him one grain of wheat on the first square and then two on the second square and four on the third square and doubling each time? And the king is like, oh great, I'm going to get out of this easy. And he finds that by the time he gets to the second rank, his kingdom is empty of wheat because this guy snookered him by being better at logarithms or something.
And in particular, when you introduce chaos into it, or the number of times that your 100 people and the next 100 people overlap.
Yeah.
But also, there are so many different, and in particular in the early 20th century, so many reporting errors. Like, to actually trace this and come up with a definitive average of how closely people are connected, in an era where you would have to, you would contact one another by post. Yeah, any one person is not a reliable. would not reliably be able to know the shortest route.
Because at the time I heard this, it seemed like an unknowable paradox, like the thing about how somewhere on the earth you have an exact doppelganger running around, you know? And the funny thing is we're now living in a time where both things like that are solvable, you know? Like, it doesn't take that long on social media to find out how many degrees you are separated away from some random Inuit guy.
But even then, it requires, I mean, it's a path that's only accessible through social media.
Yes.
And somebody my age, who half the people I went to college with or high school with, I don't think are on social media.
And the other half you've probably blocked.
And the other half, well, no. The other half I'm still DMing going like, I had such a crush on you.
They just want to talk about QAnon. They don't want to hear that.
The idea, the germ of the idea, it seems to trace back to Marconi. As he was experimenting with radio.
As he was playing the Mamba?
The idea of it, the idea of the interconnectedness of everyone dawned on him and was kind of appealing to him because he was sort of pioneering this initial broadcast medium. And he mentioned the idea of this interconnectedness as early as his 1909 Nobel Prize acceptance speech.
Really? What did he say?
I mean, his whole Nobel paper was generally about the idea that, you know, you broadcast something, it's transmitted via, further transmission towers, you know, this is early radio.
It's not a one-to-one connection anymore.
Yeah. Right? He sends something out. It's echoed or it is repeated by further repeaters. And pretty soon you get this kind of exponential growth and he's envisioning that, having an element of reciprocity. Right. And so suddenly it's a question of how do you get a message to Ethiopia from New York City, you know, the idea of interconnectedness, part of his speech. And again, this idea resonates so much with mathematicians and writers and science fiction people. And still to this day, right. That's why it resonates so strongly with us now is that it's incredibly appealing to think of yourself as only a few kisses away from anyone in the world. But the idea of 6 degrees of separation really came from a Hungarian writer by the name of, there are a lot of Hungarian names in this story because there are a lot of Hungarian mathematicians.
Let's say them all wrong as a prank.
So I'm going to say this one.
Even though we know how to say them all, let's just say them all wrong.
Well, I don't know how to say them
all. As a bit.
But a famous and celebrated Hungarian writer, Frigyes Kerinthy,
sure, that's right.
Wrote a short story as part of a collection of short stories, and the story was called Chains. And he was also chains, not change. He was speculating on all of these ideas, like how many stops along the way would it take for me to meet to make a connection to anyone in Hungary and then ultimately kind of to anyone in the world. And he kind of postulated this idea that he could get to anyone. It was almost, and within the story itself, it was kind of a dare. A character said like, I bet I can get to anybody in the world in six stops, five or six stops. And that idea was very kind of appealing.
Unfortunately, it led to The Amazing Race.
What is the Amazing Race?
Oh, I don't know. They just go around the world. Never mind.
But they don't actually meet. Do they meet other people?
No, it would be a... Yeah, they do. It would be a fun idea for... Like, this would be a fun basis for some kind of a quiz show or podcast or something where you try to connect yourself to somebody on the far side of the world.
There are a lot of TV shows... Or, I mean, sorry. There are a lot of... attempts to kind of dramatize this, and usually what ends up happening is it's sort of like 6 degrees of separation. The actual degrees of connection are not known to the characters in the sitcom or not sitcom in the drama or the film. It's a literary device where you're basically telling the story, telling six separate stories, but there's a butterfly flapping its wings across the whole thing.
This is increasingly common, and I assume it's because of this Thomas Friedman idea we all now have that, you know, it's such a smaller world. All of our actions affect people far away in ways you will never see, and because you will never see it, the only way to kind of visualize it is dramatized through these movies like Babel or
right.
What's the one about the 18 grams or whatever the soul weighs, where you kind of see these little snatches of Magnolia, where you see little snatches of a story, and then
the interconnectedness is only obvious to you as the
viewer. And we're invited to kind of apply that to our own lives and think how many little stories we pass or affect every day without knowing.
And the thing about the game itself, you know, making that connection between you and somebody else is that it's really a parlor game. It's not interesting beyond just sort of it's personal, the fun of realizing like you're only five, you know, stops along the way, but the average actually is pretty low. So doing a TV show about it, everybody would find they were five kisses away from anybody else. And
lower than six? Like is six a pessimistic guess?
So jumping ahead, you know, this is something that Twitter and Facebook both really want to explore because it's maybe one of the fundamental premises of social media is how exciting this is. And it's an idea that kind of is an under thread throughout the whole computer, you know, the whole internet age. Like, oh, this interconnectedness can't help but be a good thing. It's a social good. It's a, you know, it's so exciting. And so Facebook and Twitter, we'll see looking back how difficult it was early on to establish any kind of reliable benchmark, because how are you going to do it with sending postcards out, right? I mean, the vast majority of them don't get returned. But on Facebook, you can actually calculate how far anyone is from anyone else, and on Twitter too. And the average, Facebook's calculated average is 4.57 people.
Between any two people
accounts on Facebook. And on Twitter, it's 4.67. So weird, you know, like...
That might be the actual number, at least for internet-enabled earthlings.
Yeah, right. Right around 4.5 people away from anybody else on the internet using social media, which, as you suggested earlier, is still a smaller group. A more enclosed group than anyone in the world. I mean, as soon as you account for the Sentinelese, who are... not connected, right? It throws the average off for everyone.
There are going to be a few little islands that are impossible.
And people, you know, their whole, until Elon Musk's balloons or whatever, you know, or Bill Gates's balloons connect everyone to the internet, there are whole giant swaths of the world that aren't on the internet at all. So they're not part of this calculation. But amazing to think that when you do get tens and tens of millions of people all connected on the internet, that just following Facebook groups, you're only, you know, you're less than five people away from anybody.
Anyone.
From Kim Jong Il, right?
Does he have a Facebook page?
I'm guessing he has a Twitter account. It's just under an alias.
He's just some guy named Roberta.
But this idea went around through mathematicians, and in 1961. A mathematician by the name of Michael Gurevich started doing a study, you know, trying to codify this into an actual study of social connectedness. And his research got, you know, picked up by other mathematicians who started to really try to systematize it. Manfred Cochin and Ithiel de Sola Poole co-wrote
he's elvish.
He's absolutely an elf.
That's fantastic.
They co-wrote a paper called Contacts and Influences, and their sort of theory, and a lot of this is just postulation, right? Like just throwing a number out, imagining, and in their paper, they suggested that any two people can connect through as few as two intermediaries. But, you know, they're talking, I think,
what's the connection there? Ever passed each other at Disneyland?
In that world, they're just trying to make connections between other people, not just at MIT, because I think that would be much easier. Everybody at MIT, everybody eating in the MIT lunchroom is at least, you know, it's probably about two intermediaries. But, you know, it's a much smaller group. They're, at that time, they weren't talking about everyone in the world. And a lot of this was...
If the connection has to be sex, how high do you think the number is?
I mean, well,
a lot of virgins are off the graph altogether.
That's right. And they're going to be, they're going to be some real connectors.
And monogamously, yeah, exactly. Monogamously faithful people are just islands of two.
Right.
So there's a lot of maybe like one and two islands off there, but then you're right. There's some people that are just going to be train stations.
I think you're going to find that it's the network is going to be kind of patchy. It's going to be more closer to a neuronical
but
network.
You need people like that. Yeah. Like, I feel like super connectors like that actually make the, you know, they make the degree of separations happen, right?
Well, that's very true in the 6 degrees.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of Malcolm Gladwell concept of these people that, and in some of these MIT studies, we see that playing out, you know, and that's where Malcolm Gladwell kind of got the insight.
Oh, wow. So we wouldn't have Malcolm Gladwell if not for this.
Malcolm Gladwell had some other things going too, but
no, that was the first book, right?
Yeah, right. It was the first book. These ideas overlapped with a lot of the ideas, the mid 20th century ideas that, that governments and, you know, and state operators had some, not just obligation, but that if we were going to create a true sort of social democratic utopias, that was going to necessitate urban design on the grand scale. This is kind of the housing project era. This is the, you know, the urban redevelopment era.
So density is the goal?
Well, but density, but also architecture. I mean, the best side of that mid 20th century idea was that through architecture and technology, we were going to eliminate poverty and eliminate want. We were going to create these classless societies where everyone lived in harmony because we all had sort of perfect living environments. We were, you know, labor-saving devices. We're going to create a generation of philosopher kings who through leisure were, you know, had their time to, they could devote their time to reading Wittgenstein.
Skeptical.
Is that right? You're skeptical.
My kids won't even load the dishwasher.
But some of this, well, don't, you know, don't tell AOC. Some of this, these worlds really overlapped it in the academy at the time, the urban design people, the kind of, people that believed that the state was going to be the major driver of the, you know, of democratization, and the idea of interconnectedness and the ideas that idea spawned, it produced, as you can imagine, a proliferation of mathematics papers and sociological papers. A sociologist and mathematician and scientist and polymath by the name of Stanley Milgram.
Oh yeah,
who really is?
So he's not a one-hit wonder.
No, he's known for the Milgram experiment, which was the one where you take volunteer in off the street and you say, "Hey, we're trying to teach this this collaborator on the other side of the glass, and when they get it wrong, just give them a little electric shock, and then you know, oh geez, they're really getting, you know, like crank the electricity until they're like, ah."
And it's actually a prop person back there just screaming.
And Milgram,
and
it
turns out it's very easy to make undergraduates zap
each other. Yeah. And Milgram was doing research in obedience, you know, like people's tendency to obey science or authority figures.
Often trotted out to explain fascism and other kinds of authoritarian trends.
But Milgram also conducted the small world experiment, where he was using the work of Gurevich and Kokin and you know, actually now trying to run classical experiments to determine this 6 degrees of separation. And the way that they did it was they had a little packet that they sent out to random people in Wichita, Kansas, and Omaha, Nebraska, which to them back at MIT or at Yale
that seemed like just how, the epitome of random.
Yeah, how much further away could you be? than Wichita. And these little packets said, hi, here's what we're doing. We're trying to get you to, we're trying to see how close you are to this person in Boston, Massachusetts. And I think it might have been Milgram himself.
What a thrill to find out how close you are to Stanley Milgram.
I know, especially in 1967. And so what they asked was, send this postcard to the person you think is going to be closest to Stanley Milgram. And if you know me, send it right to me. But
send that would really break the experiment if he just sent it out to all his friends.
Send it to the person you think is going to be, is going to get this to me the fastest. And then write the name of that person that you sent it to on a separate postcard and send it to me. And then send this packet along with the postcard, you know, and it's a fairly complicated, hopeful expectation that the next person is going to get your postcard, also fill out the card who they're sending it to and send the postcard and packet to them.
Yeah.
And so Milgram is getting this flood of postcards sort of tracing a path.
Maybe not the shortest path. We don't know that, but
the path
but over. Yeah. It'll have a tendency toward efficiency as he gets a lot of them.
And the thing is that what they discovered was that most people think geographically in that sense. Do I know anyone in Boston?
That really makes more sense.
It does.
I mean, I would think, I mean, today maybe less so, but I would still think that way over who do I know who's a sociologist.
Right. And, but it turns out, you know, of course there are a lot of people that are like, oh, my brother lives in Chicago. It turns out he's dating, you know, or, yeah, you know, like it would end up being, well, you can never know how many much shorter paths.
You and I travel a lot, and I would say we still know as many people in Seattle as we do everywhere else put together, right?
Right, right. So, well, yeah, right. I mean, if you just look at your Twitter followers or mine, you know.
I mean, the internet has changed it for sure.
It has. But more it's just changed the effect of mavens. It turned out that Milgram, like a huge proportion of the postcards that actually made it to him came through one person in Boston.
Oh, there's your maven.
And what they said was that the postcards had no trouble getting to the Boston area in one or two steps. But then they floated around Boston. People in Boston kind of sending it to their friend that they thought.
Because then it's less clear how, you know, it's very easy to be like, okay, I know how to get it close to him. But once right. You're in Boston, what do you do? Ah, doesn't your sister work at?
Yeah, exactly.
Teach it. Didn't she used to teach it?
Yeah. I mean, you could just look him up in the phone book and send it directly to him.
That doesn't count.
But that doesn't count.
That breaks it. That would be like, I wonder if you did it today, would you count people you kind of know on Twitter? That's a weird social, parasocial thing.
Well, it is. And I as we'll see, like determining exactly what constitutes a connection is also part of what makes this, you know, Facebook, it's like I'm friends with a bunch of people you know, like
that's why my idea randos. To make it a sex act is a big improvement. Yes.
Although for some people,
no, you know, no virtual sex doesn't count.
Well, no, for some people, they never know the last names of the people they have sex with, or at least half of them. And what they found was that it was, the very few of them that made it to him made it through to him through a relatively small number of social links, like three or four, to get a postcard from some random person in Omaha or Wichita.
And that's even without any design of somebody trying to, somebody with knowledge of how to find the shortest way two steps away.
Yeah, this is just like, my brother lives in Boston, or I knew a guy I went to high school. But of course, these are people in Omaha and Wichita that had addresses in the phone book, so which would be more common then.
Yeah.
So they wrote several articles for that were kind of like this was all kind of fun, like so much of mathematics and sociological research at the time, and even the stuff that was very political, it also still felt kind of, you know, Richard Feynman level of like play.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I mean, I think now the political ramifications of all this stuff kind of imbues it with an extra layer of sort of fraught feeling.
Oh, you mean like how we bubble ourselves off ideologically now, right, and how we silo ourselves professionally? Yeah, I see.
But the actual research paper kind of never got published. It got published in a couple of magazine articles, but the research paper just got handed around among other mathematicians, and inspired a lot of people to investigate different different versions of this. So the idea, and you would think that the actual play Six Degrees of Separation, which was written, as you said, by John Guare, is that how you would say it? John Guare?
It looks like Guare the band.
John, well, except with an E at the end.
Do you think he's a member of
Guare? His 1990 play.
It's Guare, I think.
It's Guare.
I don't know if you say the U.
Oh, it's like Guare, like war.
What is it good for?
Huh. The average age of a combat soldier in Vietnam was 19. John Guare's 1990 play, Six Degrees of Separation, was, it was, you know, it was kind of assumed that idea came from, well, at least from
these academic treatments
or from Corinthy's, you know, story, which was pretty well known in Hungary. He claims that he got the idea from Marconi's 1909 Nobel Prize speech. So, I mean, he's obviously more erudite than we expected. But
yeah, I couldn't really rattle off too many things from Marconi's Nobel acceptance speech, just as a literary trope. And I'm me.
And you are you.
I'm 0 degrees from me.
But the play was very successful. The play, you know, starred Stockard Channing and among other luminaries, and it went through various, you know, their various touring companies, and it introduced the idea somewhat into the popular culture, at least the literary culture.
Putting it in the title is a big power move, you know. Even if you don't know, I had never seen the play or the movie, and I didn't know how the idea worked, but I knew the idea because it was the title.
Yeah, right. You understood the concept. And the movie got made when did that movie come out? 1994, 1993, the Will Smith starring, or the Will Smith vehicle, Six Degrees of Separation.
Yeah.
Really, really introduced it into mainstream consciousness. And in 1994, on one of those Inside the Actors Studio interviews with Kevin Bacon, Kevin Bacon was talking about how he had been in movies, you know, just kind of, he was, as a joking aside, he said, you know, he felt like he had worked, Kevin Bacon's a very prolific actor.
And a character actor who has played supporting roles in
so many films with so many big stars.
And maybe more of those kind of movies than a big star would be, you know, because a big star might make one or two of those a year. A supporting actor who works only 10 days on the movie might make three or four big movies a year.
And you see Kevin Bacon when you look at his CV, right? He's in Animal House. He's in a 100 movies that you wouldn't. Where he passes through, he's got a few lines.
He's perfect for this because he's the kind of person everybody knows who he is because he's got a few iconic roles. But also, you just see him everywhere. He's not one of those that guys because you can also name him.
Right.
It probably doesn't hurt that his name is Bacon.
How so?
Just if you're going to choose somebody for this game, yeah, like why not somebody whose name as well as their face and career are memorable?
Right, instead of like Mastroianni or somebody.
Exactly.
It would be hard to do. Well, that would kind of roll off the tongue, actually. 6 degrees of Mastroianni.
I mean, I love Jack Klugman, but nobody wants to play six degrees of Klugman.
But Kevin Bacon just suggested this as kind of he was definitely not trying to precipitate a game or even a challenge, mm-hmm. but it was a group of college students at Albright College in 1994 who were kind of having a Kevin Bacon film fest there in the dorm and watched Footloose and Animal House back to back or whatever they were, and started to play the game like, oh, you know, one of them had seen the Inside the Actors Studio episode and said, you know, let's try and connect Kevin Bacon to name an actor. And in the course of it, their familiarity with the film and the general concept, they invented the game 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Which is a bit of a misnomer because you can usually do it in a lot less than six.
Right? In a lot less, right. And that was what was so fun about it.
It's a small universe, the people who have been in movies. It's, you know, if six is the number for planet Earth, you would expect people you can name in movies to be a much smaller number.
Although sometimes it is a fairly convoluted path.
The idea is off the top of your head, maybe you can do it in six. Whereas if you were maximizing this using IMDb, there's probably a two or three movie answer.
And these games were all happening in a pre... in a pre-Wikipedia world. That's or the IMDb. Thing.
Do you remember playing Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon without IMDb?
Well, some people are really gifted at it. Like, you would be incredible at it because you remember people in movies, right? And I would be like, I don't remember. Harrison Ford was in Indiana Jones. What else did
he do? You're kind of doing, to some degree, you can do the postcard thing where you're like, if I need to get back in time, I need to a movie where Kevin Bacon was with an old person. I guess
right.
Jack Lemmon is in JFK, although maybe you're not supposed to use JFK in some of these variants because it's too makes it too easy.
No, and I think JFK is the is such a connector, right?
That's the maven.
Yeah. And if you trace most people, you're gonna find some big movie like that that's got a huge cast.
But you're trying to hold a bunch of people in your head as you spiral outward and you're like, you know, maybe you're working from both sides.
See, I have no idea who was in any movie. I barely remember the title of the movie I remember the plot, but I don't remember any of the actors. So this is one of these sort of trivia games that would be fun if I could do it with bands. And we'll get to that exactly. in a second.
I remember like at kind of an expert level thing, actually on paper, trying to figure out a way to connect. And I at some point I did this. I connected all these other actors named Kevin all to each other in one step and to Kevin Bacon in one step. Because, you know, Kevin Kline and Kevin Costner were both in Silverado, but Kevin Kline and Kevin Bacon were both in... I'm not sure, but something. Whereas Kevin Costner and Kevin Bacon were both in... JFK.
So everybody is just 2 degrees or 1 degree from Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, and Kevin Spacey hadn't been canceled yet. Kevin Dunn. Like, I got 4 or 5 different Kevins all to connect to each other in a sphere with Kevin Bacon in the center. And I really did feel like I had advanced the science of Baconology, although I never told anyone until right now, I think.
So this was a super fun game for nerds like you, but film nerd, you have to be a film nerd and also a nerd enough to want to play this connectivity game.
Yeah, there's
right?
kind of a math angle too. Yeah.
So and I absolutely remember when everybody was doing this, and it was just kind of like looking at the hidden picture of a dolphin by crossing your eyes. I couldn't play it.
What are you seeing?
Because I just was not. I couldn't. Not only could I not play it, but I could barely enjoy hearing other people play it. But it was a super fun game, and it persists to this day. The Bacon number, which Kevin Bacon was not into at first because he felt like it was ridiculing him.
Yeah. Actors are touchy.
Yeah, but he gradually,
because the name of the game was not Kevin Bacon is a sensitive and important character. Actor.
Kevin Bacon is a stud. He's been in all these movies. It was like, how far away are you from Kevin Bacon? He felt ridiculous, but now I think he feels like maybe the Bacon number will. I mean, it's enhanced his stature and career. No, very few other people have a number.
It's not even. It's a compliment. It's not even a backhanded compliment to say this guy has done a lot of work with actors you recognize. Like, that's not a bad thing to say.
But it may overshadow his acting career. I mean, you may now watch... I mean, can you watch a Kevin Bacon movie without thinking, no. Oh, I'm going to get a bunch of...
I think that would be... Bacon data. I assume that was his resistance, you know, to it. Right. That it was making him a
Waldo.
Yeah, he's just a...
Cog. In a cog. In a game.
Yeah, He's a space filler that could be filled by any actor, but they chose him for reasons irrelevant to his talent.
He's since embraced it. What's funny is that the popularization of the game was a result of these Albright college students thinking it was funny enough that they wrote a letter to Jon Stewart and said, "We came up with this game."
Wait, was the Daily Show even on yet?
This was 1995. So
isn't that still Craig Kilborn? No, it's pre-Daily Show, right?
It's pre-Daily
so
John, Show.
So they must be writing to Jon Stewart on his other talk show.
No, his MTV show.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And so they ended up getting invited to be on the Jon Stewart show. They also did Howard Stern, where they sat and played this game. And you can imagine that this is the exact kind of celebrity filler that shows like this crave. And that was what really ignited the game in the popular culture. And it, as a college student, as a kind of beer pong movie game. And so, you know, now 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon is in a way a method of determining other actors' status. You know, what having a Bacon number and having a close Bacon number, you know, a low Bacon number is a kind of a, you know, it's something that ends up on your Wikipedia page, or at least.
Yeah, for our working actor.
Yeah.
Like the first time you can actually do the Kevin Bacon connection, that must be exciting.
But the idea of connecting, of doing a connection game to a maven, to a hub, is actually much older. And it's around the sort of cult of personality of Hungarian mathematician Paul Erdős, who is a legendary figure in mathematics.
Is he the Kevin Bacon of?
He's the Kevin Bacon of mathematics. And he's actually like 6 degrees of Paul Erdős predates 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon by 35 years.
Did they actually call it the 6 degrees thing?
Basically, the idea of there being an Erdős number dates all the way back to 1969, an article written by mathematician Caspar Goffman. He, in writing about the way that mathematicians co-write papers with one another and the kind of that collaborative and sort of promiscuous way that math gets made as a social activity, mathematicians get together and they scrawl chicken scratches on chalkboards and they work through math problems collaboratively and then they publish collaboratively.
So, and Erdős was particularly well-known and particularly prolific?
Erdős was incredibly prolific. He wrote over 1,500 math papers or co-wrote 1,500 math papers with other writers.
And other probably leading math people if he's a big name. So it's easy to get from him to anywhere in the math world.
That's right. And he was famously, he was an eccentric, as so many of these math geniuses are. At 4 years old, he could, if you told him your age, he could calculate how many seconds you had been alive.
Oh.
In his, you know, it's just like very much a savant of math.
I can do that, but it's how many seconds you have to live.
Really?
Yeah.
I can do it, but it's how many seconds are in a minute. 60. It's same for everybody. But Erdős believed that math was intrinsically a social experience, a social activity, a social pursuit. And he did so much that he never in his adult life had a home. He's
couch surfing?
He was. He put all his belongings in one suitcase and he lived his entire life traveling from mathematician to mathematician. He would show up on your doorstep.
He'd pretend to be Sidney Poitier's nephew.
He expected you to house him and feed him. And
he's like Alf.
Do his laundry and give him, you know, like, and take him around to cocktail parties. You and he would work on a math problem. You would solve it or write a paper about it. And then he expected you to connect him with somebody else down the road.
So he was doing the Erdős number in life as well as in
he was
art.
And mathematicians loved him. He was charismatic and a colorful character. And he traveled the world, going to conferences and then shacking up with other mathematicians and working on problems.
Here's a question. Do you feel like your band had enough popularity that you could do this?
No, but a band just slightly, and I think it's cultural too. Like if you're a punk rock band,
you're already couch surfing,
right? Like Mudhoney could travel the world and be put up in super cool squats all around the universe for the rest of their lives.
I feel like you could do it based on podcast listenership alone.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, okay. If you take that into consideration, I could absolutely throw some stuff in a small bag, hit the road, and never come home.
Let's do the math. You have tens of thousands of listeners. Yes. What percentage of them would be willing to let you sleep on their couch?
I bet you...
1 in 3?
I bet you there are 1,500 to 2,000 people in the world right now who would let me crash on the couch. Yeah.
So even if you live 50 more years,
and some of them would have me for a couple of nights.
Right.
Some of them would happily have me for 2 weeks, at which point I would start to smell. And
I mean, if there's really 2,000, you really only need to average about every week or two, I think.
Yeah. Right. So absolutely possible. And if I wrote a paper with each one of those people?
You write a song.
Wait a minute. What am I doing with my life? Why am I not doing
you
this?
You record a podcast with each person. This is a great idea, actually.
Bow, wow, 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 wow. You just invented the Roderick number. Have you done a podcast? How many podcasts are you away from having done a podcast with John Roderick?
I don't know what my equivalent would be. I mean, everybody you see on Jeopardy every night has beaten me on Jeopardy by the transitive property.
Right.
So maybe your Jennings number is just how many people.
Interesting.
How many people you are away from beating me on Jeopardy. Because if you didn't beat me, you beat somebody who beat me. Or more likely, you beat somebody who beat, you know, a few hundred times who beat me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. What's your Jeopardy number or your Jennings number? What's your Roderick number? These are going to be things that futurelings probably know about themselves. They're going to have it on their business cards.
They should trade and brag.
But the Erdos number was something that became a kind of source of pride among mathematicians.
You're going a low one, yeah.
And also, you know, sociologists and social scientists, let's say, because of the overlap of mathematics and urban design and social theorists and linguists, you know, there's a lot of collaboration from people.
It's allowed to be outside the mathematical field.
Yeah. As long as you co-write an academic paper with someone who has co-written an academic paper with Erdos or, you know, up the chain,
you can
legitimately have an Erdos number. And it's what keeps me from having an Erdos number because I have never co-written an academic paper. But what we have discovered about you is that, and I think your book with Martin Gardner absolutely qualifies.
You think?
Absolutely, it does. Given
it wasn't peer reviewed.
No, but given the number of you know things that I've seen that do qualify one for an Erdos number, yours does. And Martin Gardner has an Erdos number of one. He co-wrote a paper with Erdos, meaning you have an Erdos number of two.
Is that true?
Which is the same Erdos number that Einstein has.
Wow.
It is an exceptionally low Erdos number. And the problem is that Erdos is dead. And so no one can there are no new Erdos numbers of one.
But you can, you know, it can extend into the past and in the future, obviously.
But the lowest one you can have is a two now. That's the lowest number that anybody could have that didn't actually co-wrote a paper with it. So when you told me that at the top of the show, I was so thrilled because—
What an honor for you to be sitting here with somebody with such a low Erdos number.
Well, it really is because what it suggests is that you might actually have an Erdos Bacon Sabbath number.
And what is that?
We'll get to this in just 1 second. So—
Is this like the EGOT of John Guare games?
It absolutely is. So— When the Bacon number became part of the popular culture, it obviously resonated with all the math people who had already been using Erdos numbers for years as a sign of your kind of prominence and connectedness as a mathematician. And so there were people immediately who began to wonder if there were people that had a Erdos Bacon number.
Right. You'd have to be both in a movie or, you know, connect in a movie and an author of an academic paper.
Right. And there are, maybe not surprisingly, quite a few people who have Erdos Bacon numbers. And an Erdos Bacon number, you have to have, you know, it's determined by, you add your Bacon number and your Erdos number together? Is that right?
It's additive.
It's additive. So, oh, wait. No, it's not true because I think
you average them.
Do you average them?
I don't know.
How is it calculated? Hang on.
No, it's the sum.
They're added together. Yeah. So, Richard Feynman, for example, somebody that you would expect would have a Bacon or an Erdos Bacon number because he's a mathematician, but also
a pop culture person.
He has an Erdos number of three because it goes through Nicholas Metropolis and...
Let's see. With Nicholas Metropolis, he wrote a paper on the equations of the state of elements based on Fermi-Thomas theory.
Right.
Metropolis and Stanislaw Ulam, as you know, did a paper on probabilities called the Monte Carlo method. And then Ulam and Paul Erdos wrote a set theory paper called On Equations with Sets as Unknown. So he's just three people away from
Polish. Feynman is three people, but he also has a Bacon number of three.
Did he act? What's his movie credit?
Yeah, he was in...
I see. He's in a science fiction movie called...
Anti-Clock.
Anti-Clock.
Yeah.
What is that?
Stephen Hawking has a very low Bacon number because he was in... he appeared alongside John Cleese in a Monty Python live sort of
like a filmed,
film.
A filmed performance?
But his Erdős number is four because, you know, he's four distant from having actually written a paper with Erdős.
I'm very interested in Feynman's film career. I guess there's a little known actor named Tony Tang who is just a bit part in both Anti-Clock and the Guy Ritchie crime movie Snatch. And Snatch, of course, has mumbly Brad Pitt, who is also in Sleepers with our boy Kevin Bacon.
Carl Sagan also has a lower Bacon number than an Erdős number. His Bacon number is only two and his Erdős number is four. But what's interesting is that there are a lot of people coming from the Bacon side of the equation that have Erdős numbers, including Danica McKellar, who was Winnie Cooper in Wonder Years.
But is now famously a mathematician.
Mathematician. And also Natalie Portman, who co-wrote a math paper.
At Yale.
At Yale, right.
Yeah, I guess the reason why the Bacon number would often be lower than the Erdős number is just probably a function of the fact that these math papers have three or four collaborators max, whereas a movie will have 50 performers or more.
Right. And a lot of the math people who have Bacon numbers are either sport casting, appearing as a walk-on, as a mathematician, or they're in documentaries or...
Do we count that?
Well, this is the problem with the popularity of having an Erdős number means that people want to have that collaboration lead to Erdős, and the popularity of 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon.
And most of them have not been in a scripted film.
Well, so the Bacon rules, which were stipulated by their inventors at Albright College, are that it cannot be a television show. It cannot be a play. You have to have been in a film with Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, because then I have no Bacon number then, because any of my credits would be TV.
So I was really curious if I had a Bacon number. And so in not understanding the rules at first, I thought I had a Bacon number of three because I have quite a few connections that do have Bacon numbers of two. I did a television show with Dick Cavett. I've been on TV with Hodgman many times, and they both have Bacon numbers of two through various films.
Hodgman was in the Arthur remake? No.
His Bacon number is calculated through the movie Learning to Drive, where he's co-starred with Patricia Clarkson. And then she was in Beyond All Boundaries with Kevin Bacon. So I was really psyched that I had a Bacon number of three. And then I realized that TV didn't count. So then I tried to make my Bacon connection through the Drew Barrymore film Mad Love, which I did show up for the filming of Mad Love as an extra in the grunge rock party scene.
Is it shot here?
It was shot in Seattle. I was in the crowd, but halfway through the filming, I got bored and they were serving apple juice as beer. So we were all standing around with pints of apple juice looking like we were having a beer party. But the Comet Tavern was right across the street and they served real beer. And so I excused myself from the filming to go across the street and get myself a glass of actual beer back when beer mattered to me a lot. And then somehow by means of conversation across the street, I didn't make it back to the rest of the filming, which lasted through the night. People have said they see me in a pan shot as Drew Barrymore is walking down the ramp at the formerly Moe's. But I'm not sure that I'm actually in the film. I'm certainly not credited. But then I realized that I did appear as a credited actor in the Charles Mudede movie, Thin Skin.
Oh, I thought it was going to be the horse one.
No, it's about Aham and his one-man show.
Yeah. Is it a, is just a filmed, is it a filmed?
It's a feature film.
A Hamalua show, or is it a,
it's dramatized. Yeah. A scripted film. And I appear as a kind of manager in the office. I walk down the stairs at one point carrying a file. I'm actually in the background of like three or four scenes and I'm in the credits. And through Dwayne Kennedy, who appears in the film, who was in the movie Talking Dirty After Dark with Martin Lawrence. This is a chain of connection that you wouldn't expect.
There's no way Martin Lawrence is the closest way to connect you to, is it?
That my closest connection is through Martin Lawrence and then through Stephen Tobolowsky, who is in Murder in the First with Kevin Bacon. So I have a Bacon number confirmed of 4. It might be lower, but that's the closest I could get. And you're saying that you've never appeared in a feature film, so
I guess
you don't.
I've been in a couple documentaries, and not just archival footage of me, but I've actually been interviewed.
So I think that counts.
I may be able to make it happen, but I've never.
The idea that you would have a Bacon or an Erdős Bacon Sabbath number is so exciting to me.
I don't feel like I could have the Sabbath number. What are the qualifications for that?
Well, so in rock and roll, Black Sabbath is famous for having had a lot of touring musicians, people that joined the band for a tour to, you know, kind of bulk up the sound. Plus, Ozzy has collaborated with every single person in the universe. Yeah. And so Sabbath...
I feel like I would not pick them as the nexus of all. It's a little metal-centric, this...
Right, except that's kind of what makes it interesting, right? An Erdős number...
I guess the contrast.
You know, a Kevin Bacon number, like Sabbath is...
But if you were just, you know, if you just wanted to share the stage, you'd pick somebody with you'd pick Dylan or something.
Yeah, right. Or Dylan would be the obvious one. Or one of these, you know, modern musicians who collaborates with everybody.
Sure. Moby. Or just some pan-genre person. Johnny Cash.
But using the Sabbath number, you can connect pretty much everyone in rock and roll. We'll find a connection to Sabbath within 4 or 5 people. My Sabbath number is pretty low. I have a 3 Sabbath number because Duff McKagan made a record with Ozzy and Mike Squires plays in Duff McKagan's band and Mike played on the Long Winters record.
And it does have to be a recorded performance or is it a single stage sharing moment?
So I think it has to be a recorded performance because anybody can get up on stage. I mean, if it's up on stage, I have a Sabbath number of 2. And so there are these, you know, there are restrictions with a Bacon number just to keep everybody in the world from having one. Like Erdős, you have to have published a paper. You can't just have shared a stage with him or passed him in an airport. But once the Sabbath number was established, of course, the idea that there would be people who had an Erdős Bacon Sabbath number.
Who is recording as well as who has a number?
Well, so the Erdős Bacon Sabbath number was kind of a joke that was first suggested by a blogger, like an early internet, not early internet, but like mid-period internet blogger by the name of Time Blimp, who in 2011 had a website, you know, that was. Like we see a billion of them now that are just clearing houses of weird stuff on the internet. Like, check it out. You'll never guess. And Time Blimp was the first one to put the 3 together and say, who has an Erdős Bacon Sabbath number? And it turned out a lot of people do. And you can imagine that there are a lot of mathematicians who, by appearing in a documentary film or playing the violin with a symphony at some point, can trace some path. But there are some surprising people with Erdős Bacon Sabbath numbers, like, for instance, Condoleezza Rice has one.
So what's the recording there? If a sample of her voice gets dropped into something, is that how she makes the Sabbath?
So the problem with Condoleezza Rice is that her Bacon number comes through television. She was on an episode of 30 Rock.
Well, the other problem with her is, you know, the last 20 years of endless war.
Well, sure. But
aside from that,
but she actually played piano in a Brahms
pianist
production with Yo-Yo Ma, which, as you can guess through Sting, gets you to Sabbath pretty fast.
So her problem is the bacon problem.
Well, that's the place where it feels a little bit tenuous. If you're following the,
I'm sure she's a talking head in some documentary that had actual release. No,
that's her lowest. Her lowest path. But, you know, the Albright students were pretty particular that television doesn't count. Imogen Heap has one, and, you know, Imogen wrote co-wrote a paper called Musical Interaction with Hand Posture and Orientation that, you know, her Erdos number is quite large, but her Sabbath number, she collaborated with John Bon Jovi, who, through Alice Cooper, has a pretty good Sabbath number. Let's see who are some of the other ones are. Nope. Sorry. Deep. Stephen Hawking has a Sabbath number because he actually, his voice was sampled in a Pink Floyd record.
I mean, the sample would be the equivalent of if footage of me on Jeopardy was used in some documentary, but I'd never actually showed up. Do you think that's okay for bacon number?
Well, it appears
it's given Stephen Hawking his what are we calling this? BES number?
The EBS number.
EBS put Erdos first.
Mr. Rogers has an EBS number. It's pretty easy.
Because he sang with Ozzy that one time.
He did again, it was through Yo-Yo Ma and Yo-Yo Ma through Sting. So Yo-Yo Ma and Sting are big connectors, and you can imagine how that would be. Lisa Kudrow has co-wrote a paper called Handedness and Headache that through a very long chain gets her an Erdos number.
She has an academic paper, huh?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Although she co-wrote it with Lee Kudrow. So, and Lee Kudrow then, you know, Lee Kudrow then wrote a paper called Sleep Apnea in Cluster Headache, and it got much more scientific after that.
I've been spending a lot of time trying to get Condi Rice's bacon number more legit, and it looks like it's very easy to do. She's interviewed for a 2018 documentary about the Carlyle Hotel that George Clooney and Tommy Lee Jones and Jeff Goldblum. So Tommy Lee Jones right there gets you to
sure,
Kevin Bacon and JFK in a number of two.
Albert Einstein actually has a connection to Black Sabbath because he played violin with the Juilliard String Quintet. But it's listed as a private performance. So again, it's fairly tenuous, right? It's fun to do, but also kind of fun to smudge. Natalie Portman famously has a actual co-authorship in on a science paper about frontal lobes, and then, you know, Kevin Bacon, easy to do.
Do we know who the lowest Erdos Bacon Sabbath number is, and is it legit? Or does it use some sketchy TV documentary? I mean, it can't be that much lower than 5 or 6. I mean, I don't know if that's possible.
The thing, like, Brian May of Queen is an astrophysicist.
Right.
And also in Queen.
That's what I hear.
And so he's got to have a very, very low one. Winnie, you know, the actress that played Winnie Cooper has a 6, which is super low.
But that's only Erdos Bacon. Oh, Brian.
No.
That's Sabbath? That's
Sabbath, too. Her,
I think her Erdos Bacon number is 6.
Oh, is 6.
But Brian May's Erdos Bacon Sabbath number appears to be 9.
Right. So not the lowest. The lowest EBS number is 5.
Wow.
Which was held by Mike Ancus. The problem with the documentation around the Erdos Bacon Sabbath number is that this was very exciting in about 2011. And a man by the name of Ross Churchley actually had the website erdosbaconsabbath.com, where he kind of compiled all the sort of, I mean, this was something that people loved to do in pre-Wiki days or early Wiki days. And so he had all this information cataloged at Erdos Bacon Sabbath, and then he stopped paying the money for the site and it went defunct. And you seem to have a way to look at old websites that I don't.
It's the Internet Wayback Machine.
Internet Archive. So if I put in Erdos Bacon Sabbath.
Hey, I have the answer to your Mike Ankus question.
Oh.
I guess a bunch of people with, they were trying to prove the theoretical low bound of an Erdos Bacon Sabbath number. So they got people with acting credits to publish a paper together at a conference and then performed a song together at the conference. And the people were just chosen for their
low bacon numbers.
Proximity to bacon and or air to shore.
Boo!
And Mike Ankus, as a result of, you know, if you count performing a song at this conference together,
right,
and writing it and co-authoring this kind of phony baloney paper called Reductio Ad Absurdum, which was just about the lowest theoretical, they slapped their names on this paper on the lowest theoretical bound of Erdos Bacon Sabbath number. So his Mike Ankus is now five, but you've got to count their YouTube stage performance. And
yeah,
you know,
that's fake.
Which appeared in a subsequent short documentary about the project.
So as I look at this, there's a website called the Oracle of Bacon, oracleofbacon.org.
Yeah, it's like it's an engine of finding bacon numbers for a given person, right?
Yeah, where you can put names in and find out how close they are. And it had not occurred to me to do until just now. I spent all this time trying to connect myself to Kevin Bacon
sexually
through Martin Lawrence, through Dwayne Kennedy, and my name appears in the Oracle of Bacon, and this claims I have a bacon number of 2, because
what?
Because apparently I was in a movie called Lennon or McCartney, which was a documentary about what musicians think about the Beatles. And they,
how do you not know you're in this documentary?
Well, I think what they did was they found interviews with musicians where they talked about Lennon or McCartney, and then they excerpted clips of the musician talking and put it in this feature film. So
I'm looking this up now.
Through the Oracle of Bacon, I have a bacon number of 2 because I was in Lennon or McCartney. And Chris Pine was in Lennon or McCartney, and he was in Beyond All Boundaries with Kevin Bacon.
This is a 34-minute movie with 550 archived celebrity responses. So you were probably in that movie for less than 10 seconds.
And I'm almost certain that I said that George Harrison was my favorite Beatle, although I've never seen the movie Lennon or McCartney.
This says there were 15 people who said George Harrison, so you're not even original. The guy who said Oasis, that was a true original.
Yeah, he's a kook.
I'm going to assume it's Noel Gallagher.
How many people said Lennon or McCartney? There were over 500 musicians.
Yeah, Lennon wins. And it's not all musicians, obviously, since you said Chris Pine is in it.
Right.
It's luminaries of all sorts. Lennon won by 94 votes.
Wow.
No, 86 votes.
Harsh toke. Well, now this is confusing. If we accept this...
Yeah, because this is not a movie you had to do anything for. They used existing clips of you and put it in a movie. So that would help my chances too, honestly.
And I had never heard of this before, and I've never seen this movie, but it's in the Oracle of Bacon. And so you have to assume that it counts, right? Because you're in a...
You think the Oracle is an actual Oracle?
I mean, there it is. It's the Oracle of Bacon.
It's actually canonical?
It has a statue of a Greek, like some kind of Greek Oracle on one side and Kevin Bacon on the other. But now tell me what this means, because Ozzy is in the Oracle of Bacon.
Yes.
I'm sorry, in the Oracle of this movie, Lennon or McCartney.
I wonder what he said. Yeah, Ozzy and Geezer Butler are both in this movie.
Ozzy is absolutely 100% a Paul McCartney fan, so he would not be abashed at that.
What this means is...
But can you get a Sabbath number by being in a documentary with Ozzy? I don't think so.
I mean, do you count this whole thing as a 35-minute spoken word piece that you could really rock out to?
Oh,
I mean, if so, that means it's a real We Are the World stage that you have shared with Alanis Morissette, Charlie XCX, Guillermo del Toro, Haley Joel Osment, Tina Fey... Boy, this is amazing. You guys could do great work. Most of Metallica.
If I have a Bacon number of 2 and a Sabbath number of 3, let's leave it at 3 because that's one where I can trace an unbroken chain of recordings. Does that mean I have a Bacon Sabbath number of 5?
I guess. I should also note at this point that
yeah.
I think I have overstated my Erdős number, or rather understated
I overstated it because I was the one that.
Well, because I was looking at Gardner's attention. Wikipedia entry says that he has an Erdős number of 1, but when I looked into the claim, it turns out to be one of he was famous for his April Fool's columns, and it turns out to be an April Fool's joke about a Kurdish paper, an obscure Kurdish paper that Gardner collaborated with Erdős on. In fact, but he does have a very low Erdős number of 2, which would make mine 3.
Erdős number of 3 is incredibly low.
I just need that.
So we need a Bacon number for you, and then
some tambourine.
Somehow I'm going to get you a Sabbath number, but I would like a person listening to the show who has the lowest Erdős number that if they think they're the lowest Erdős number, please, please figure out a way where we can collaborate.
And that concludes Erdős Bacon Sabbath. Entry 423.JB3104, certificate number 32655, in the omnibus. Now, Futurelings, you don't have to deal with the scourge of social media. You're a lucky, lucky group of cyborg crustaceans. But in our day, as products of our time, we were at Omnibus Project, wherever you cared to look for us. I'm at Ken Jennings on Twitter. You can find John via his Patreon. You could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. The best way to support the show, there's so many ways to support the show. You could, I'm kind of out of ideas. The main way to support the show would be to support our Patreon, which is at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Really, Omnibus is a going concern thanks to your generosity and support. And I think a lot of the supporters enjoy the fun perks that they get, including a bonus episode every month. So check that out if you're missing out on, if 9 to 10 omnibi a month are a little low. You could send us physical artifacts, like if you want to send John copies of your prospective research, if he's going to audition multiple mathematicians, you may want to send him copies of your research so he knows you're legit.
Weirdly, in the about 5 or 6 years ago, I was getting mysterious anonymous emails from a woman who claimed to be the handler of a brilliant mathematician who was about to blow the lid off of the world with he had invented something. It had a little bit of the flavor of all that hype that went into the release of the Segway. Do you remember that when it was suggested that, you know, tomorrow we're going to announce this thing, it's going to revolutionize the world?
It had a name like Project Tangerine, and everyone was like, what is Project Tangerine that's going to remake American cities? Is it cold fusion? Is it jetpacks?
Yeah, it's a hovercraft, and then it turned out to be the Segway, and everybody was like, huh. But she was writing me for over the space of a year, and what she said, she listened to one of my podcasts and said, listen, I feel like you're the person who would best be able to understand the work of this man and explain it to the world. And we want to use you as the spokesperson for his invention or his insight. And I was like, a little dubious, but
Dean Kamen's famous. Was it him?
No, it was. So the problem was she continued to say, I cannot reveal his name. I cannot tell you more. I just want you to know that you're our chosen interlocutor, and one day soon I will send you everything and we'll fly you out here to Cape Canaveral where we're going to reveal our time portal or whatever. And then one day she just stopped contacting me. It seemed to be, you know, working to a head, and then she just disappeared. And I feel like maybe she...
Was it after you wrote her a large check to set up the meeting?
No, I think she probably stepped into the time portal and is gone. But maybe I'll meet her later in life. Maybe that's why she talked to me, because she knows in the future, futurelings will worship us as gods. So have we got any mail in our mailbag?
Yeah, I'm looking at the, some stuff there. Let's see. Mark sent us. Oh, I think he sent you a harmonica in the past.
Thanks, Mark.
And he found something else cool from his dad, which is in a sweet leather case with a...
That is a sweet case.
With kind of a...
Oh, it looks like a slide rule. Is it a slide
rule?
How
did you know? Yes, this is a slide rule case.
Look at that.
That belonged to...
Is this how I get
Mark's
my Erdos number?
Yeah. I wonder if Mark's dad would write a paper with you. This is his mid-60s slide rule, which comes... I didn't realize they had these kind of cool belt... Because you never want to be without it.
Right.
You're walking, like a cell phone.
Walking around, you know, the project site.
So it's got a key ring thing you clip to your belt and even a little like luggage tag with his name and address. If found, please return to Seaburg, Alabama.
No. Well, you know, the space program had an Alabama connection.
That's true.
What was happening in Seaburg, Alabama?
What even is Seaburg? Is there a Charlottesburg, Alabama?
Oh, C-hyphen-berg. So, yeah,
it's like a C-apostrophe-berg. And then it's A-L-A, which is typically Alabama and not. I need a list of census-designated places in the state of Alabama. Childersburg seems to be the most likely candidate.
And
here.
Is it a space program site? Childersburg?
Talladega County. The Alabama Army Ammunition Plant was located there.
There it is.
So, I mean, that's World War II era, but if it was still going in the... Oh, here we go. The plant also secretly produced heavy water to support the Manhattan Project.
Hooray! So, wait a minute.
So it was a DuPont plant for explosives, but they also did heavy water.
But almost certainly that this father, whose slide rule this is, knew some Manhattan people who knew
Paul Erdős.
Feynman.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Who have Erdos numbers. So maybe owning this slide rule is my path.
It's quite possible that your prospective co-author here is no longer with us.
Oh, sure.
I mean, but maybe Mark could introduce us to one of his co-authors who is still alive.
Did you ever learn to use a slide rule?
I have not.
When I was in fifth grade.
Do you know how to do it?
When I was in fourth grade, I'm sorry, I was in one of those gifted and talented classes. And the way that they treated gifted kids in the 70s was basically to bully them. And say like, oh, you're smart, huh? How smart are you? Do you want to learn to use a slide rule? And so they taught us how to use a slide rule.
That is a mild kind of bullying, to teach someone to use a slide rule.
There was a picture of me in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer in 1978 as a kid in a Cub Scout uniform using a slide rule, except it was a giant slide rule. And now I don't remember how to do it.
I also got to know, this one's just to me. Sorry. It's happy birthday. From Julie, a late 40s Gen Xer, who says she liked the Samantha Smith episode and she feels that our Gen X content represents our generation and struggles accurately.
Hey, thank you.
From her perspective.
Thank you. From our perspective, too.
Tackling the challenges of being between 47 and 52. Is that what this show is about? Apparently.
No. You can listen to this show at any age.
But in her view, that's the overarching theme of the show. Is this the travails of being between 47 and 52?
You're 47.
I am.
I'm 52.
You are.
So there it is. We encounter generation gaps all the time.
She also sent me a $5 bill.
Hey!
It's because it's my birthday. I'm not going to share it with you.
Oh.
Maybe she sent you something in September. Yeah. September, is that right?
She sounds like a grandma.
Well, she actually wrote, your fan, middle-aged, quote, grandma, Julie. And I don't think she's actually a grandma. She's just a grandma in the sense that she just sent me a $5 bill.
Yeah.
And a Sierra Club card of Yosemite, I think. I can't actually tell. Thank you, Julie.
Well, happy belated birthday, Ken, although I celebrated your birthday in the moment.
And I guess what else did I say? Oh, and you can find your fellow futurelings, possibly even Mark or Julie, who are now celebrities. Now they have Jennings Roderick numbers of one because we've mentioned them on the show.
Hmm.
Yeah, compute how far you are away from someone who's been mentioned on Omnibus.
A Jennings Roderick number. I really like that a lot. Or having collaborated with us.
You have to have met them in person, right? You can't just like, because otherwise the Facebook group, the Discord, all these futurelings destinations to which I commend you, they would just immediately get in 1,000 people.
You can have a Jennings Roderick number by by being mentioned on the show, but then to get a further one, you have to meet the person.
The first step is just with the podcast. It's just mentioning on the podcast.
Is it a Jennings-Roderick number or a Roderick Jennings number?
Roderick Jennings. They both sound pretty good. I don't have a strong... I don't care about if my name is first. Like, I just like the strong name to be second. Maybe Jennings Roderick.
I think Jennings Roderick is good, yeah.
Roderick Jennings sounds like a single person who is a solicitor.
Right. Roderick Jennings. But Jennings Roderick, that's a great hyphen.
It really is.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.